Now, you've recently been quoted as saying that the tide is turning against the Taliban. Given the contrary views to that, how do you back that up?
Well, what I actually said was that we have reversed the Taliban's momentum in some areas, and to be very precise about that, because I would not say that we have reversed the momentum in all areas by any means. I think in some we've reversed it, some we have blunted it, some perhaps the Taliban is still trying to expand. But in some very important areas, starting again in Helmand province, in the six central districts of Helmand, you take an area like Marja. Certainly the enemy is still fighting to take back Marja, but the fact is that Marja, one of the most important command and control centers for the Taliban and a nexus with the illegal narcotics industry bosses, is no longer in their control. In fact, last week, voter registration was carried out for the upcoming parliamentary elections in Marja, something that was unthinkable 6 months ago. I've walked through the market in Marja. And the same can be said in a number of other areas, again, in those six central districts, and even outside them. I was in Nowzad the other day, outside those six districts, an area that was controlled by the Taliban until a few months ago. There's a small Marine contingent from the United States there that's now partnered with Afghan soldiers and police, supported by the elders. They have taken the village back from the Taliban, run them out. And where there were only four shops in the market a few months ago, there are now 200, and it's growing. Only a few families were there under the Taliban. There's now over 10,000 citizens back and growing gradually back up to the 30,000 that it was before the Taliban invested it, if you will, and caused such problems. As I mentioned, the deliberate campaign has begun in Kandahar. In some areas, the Taliban momentum has reversed, but clearly there's a lot more work to be done, and the Taliban fighting back very hard, because this is really Mullah Omar's hometown, if you will. This is the iconic place of the Taliban, and so it's very important to them, and that will be tough. Indeed, in Helmand, they're fighting back there as well. That's to be expected. That's what happens when this is the same as what happened in Iraq when we started taking away the sanctuaries and safe havens of al-Qaeda. The enemy fights back. And this is why I've said for over a year, actually, with respect to Afghanistan, when I was in my previous job at Central Command, that the going would get tougher before it got easier, harder before it got easier. Kabul security has been reinforced. This is the strategically important security bubble. It has really gone quite well in Kabul, and we want to keep expanding that. Certainly the Haqqani network in particular, from its home base in Miramshah in North Waziristan, is trying to cause problems. That's who was behind the attacks in Khost the other day, in which over 30 Haqqani network members were killed. Seven suicide vests were found on them. A car bomb was defused. And the overall commander of that operation was killed as he was trying to drive back to Pakistan when he realized that the attacks had failed. But that's an indicator of the scale that they can achieve in carrying out attacks on bases. And although they have not penetrated a base, per se, with anything meaningful, the fact is that they still did have the capability to do that. So there's no question about the additional work that needs to be done in the East and in the approaches, if you will, and the rat lines that come in from the sanctuaries into Afghanistan and then lead to Kabul. In the North, there's been some good work by German forces in southern Baghlan province. More work is clearly recognized as needed in the rest of Baghlan and then also up in Kunduz, where there's the beginning of an operation as well. And then out in Badghis and Ghormach, a U.S., Italian, and Spanish force together augmented with some special operations forces is seeking to reverse the momentum out there. So as you walk around the country and then even down in southern Herat, the Pashtun gateway to Herat province, the Zarako Valley, that tide has been turned certainly there as well by a great special forces team from the United States with some locals who got tired of the Taliban and just needed a little bit of support. Now have linked up with the Afghan police as well.
Now the Americans are putting in the main effort here. You're the fourth successive U.S. commander here. This is America's war, isn't it?
Well, I think it's the world's war, really. I think, as I mentioned earlier, the interests here are vital to all the freedom-loving people of the world. I don't think anyone wants to see transnational extremists able to do what they did from the soil here, what they have planned in some cases from other places in the region. It is a regional problem as well, but certainly all of our countries, many of our countries certainly, have experienced transnational extremist attacks and recognize the importance of doing all that we can to achieving our mutual objectives here, that, again, Afghanistan not become a sanctuary for transnational extremists.
There are certain nations present here on the ground who are accused of not doing enough and criticized for avoiding sort of tough tasks, etc. Is this really one team, one mission?
Well, it is one team, one mission. It is certainly one team in which some of the different members have caveats. That's alliance activities. That's what happens. I remember when I've been a NATO guy almost all my life, starting as a lieutenant, now as a four-star general, as a 1, 3, and four-star, was in charge of NATO forces or a senior staff officer. In Bosnia, we had a matrix on the desk. I was the chief of operations there, and we had a matrix on the desk, and it had the countries down one side and the missions and the geographic areas across the top, and there were caveats, there were limits. That's natural, actually. Again, this is the way these play out, frankly. I would point out, though, that I think that virtually every one of the troop-contributing countries here has sustained tough losses and tough casualties. And indeed, some of the smallest countries, if you look at their losses per capita, Denmark, per se, for example, you'll see that, again, there is a great sharing of the hardship and the sacrifice in this effort, without question.
Now, we've seen that the number of Afghan soldiers and police are rising, but are they rising at a fast enough rate, and is the quality matching that rise?
Well, you've got to be very careful to try to accelerate the development, the growth of host nation forces without rushing to failure because you go so fast that you jettison quality along the way. And you're trying to achieve quantity and quality. Quantity in a counterinsurgency operation does have a quality of its own, but only if it's at a certain quality. And so, again, you're trying to achieve that threshold. The fact is that this is another area in which we only recently really got the big ideas right. I'd say it was only late last fall. For the police, for example, that we actually came to the concept that you should actually train them before you put them in their positions. Prior to that, there was an idea that you hire them, you put them in position, and then you train them when they get to that. That's obviously not a great formula. It was an expedient formula because of a variety of challenges, I understand that, and because of lack of sufficient capacity to train all that needed to be trained at that time. We have now expanded that capacity enormously with the development of NATO Training Mission Afghanistan, and as that has come along, and as have the troop-contributing nations have contributed more to this very important effort. But again, we've got to try to achieve both. And by the way, I'd add that the even bigger challenge than just training individual soldiers and police in sufficient numbers is the development of leaders. You can't just put someone right out of high school or college through a 14-week course and label that individual lieutenant colonel and give him command of an infantry battalion. That requires years of experience, years of training, and years of education, which is really the process that has to be followed. And you can only shortcut that so much. And that's where you have the biggest of these challenges. As you may know, I commanded the NATO training mission in Iraq, also the Multinational Security Transition Command Iraq. And we had the same kinds of challenges there as we grew a force even more rapidly and larger than is the development of this force.
But are we on track, though, to meet the target numbers that we need for the Afghan army and Afghan police? Because I understand that we're down by about 280 teams of trainers that are needed.
We actually are on track. In fact, we're slightly ahead of track. The army declared meeting its 134,000 goal for October at the end of July, for example, and the police are several thousand ahead as well. But the goals are very ambitious. The growth is very significant that will have to take place. And again, we're going to have to work very hard to do that. And indeed, we are short trainers. Again, you'd have to say when it is because the growth of trainers in their requirement is commensurate with the growth of the force. But so we're We're short about 700 or so trainers alone right now. And then there are the mentor teams or the military liaison teams. Again, there are different names for these advisor elements that are out with the military units and the police as well.
So what's being done to try and appeal to fill those training positions?
Well, indeed, we've just submitted our latest force request up the NATO chain, and then there are also some separate ones that I can submit as a U.S. commander as well up the U.S. chain.
Okay. Have you had responses yet? Is it, you know, countries?
There are, yes. No, in fact, as each leader comes through here, we're quite forthright in making our views and requirements known. And a number of those countries have gone back and pledged additional numbers. But again, there's still a gap between the pledges and what we will need.
Now, there have been a few incidents this year of Afghan soldiers killing ISAF soldiers. Are the Afghans reliable allies?
They are. And in fact, Afghans have been dying at much greater numbers than have our forces, for what it's worth. I mean, people occasionally say, when will the Afghans start shouldering the burden? Well, they are. And in particular, when it comes to casualties. Beyond that, by the way, they say, well, when will they take the lead in security somewhere? And I say, well, you're sitting in a place, typically, if it's an interview in Kabul, the Afghans have been in the lead in Kabul for some period, and they have done it quite well. And let's remember that Kabul is 1/6 of the population of this country. So Afghan forces indeed are shouldering the burdens. They are in the lead, certainly partnered with a very fine Turkish-led regional command. But nonetheless, they are the face of security for the Afghan people here in Kabul. Now, with respect to those incidents, those are a very, very tragic reality of this kind of effort. We had those in Iraq, as you may recall. An insurgent dressed as a soldier even blew up a mess hall there with dozens of our soldiers killed in it. In some cases, we've even had it within our own ranks. I mean, this is one of these true tragedies of the kind of the nature of what it is that we are doing. Obviously, we try to vet those in the forces as carefully as we possibly can. We have an extensive biometric campaign and background checks, if you will, before people can volunteer. But the possibility of an infiltrator is something that cannot be eliminated.
So your message to the troops on the ground that have to work day in, day out with ANSF is what?
Well, I don't know that they need a message from me. I think that they actually realize that it is essential that we partner. They know that. They send that message to me, in fact. They say, we've got to live with them. We've got to plan with them. We have to fight with them. We have to, in some cases, shed blood with them in the face of the enemy.
Every time you're questioned, there's talk of July next year and whether you'll be ready to start withdrawing troops down. How are things looking right now?
Well, let me start by reminding you again what July 2011 represents. First of all, what it represented in the speech that President Obama gave at West Point on the 1st of December last year, and I was there, he asked me to attend that with him, was it represented a message of urgency that we have to get on with this, that we've been at it by that time by 8 years or more, and we have to make progress. And then that complemented the message of additional commitment that he made, where that was the commitment of an additional 30,000 forces on top of some more than that already that had been committed during 2009, the funding for the additional 100,000 Afghan National Security Forces and the tripling of the U.S. civilian numbers here. And that was how that was presented, with a very clear description then and since then as well, that July 2011 is a time when a process begins, the pace of which is determined by conditions on the ground. And the tasks are to hand off to Afghan forces where that is possible, where they can take on the tasks for themselves in the security conditions that obtain, and then also to hand off to some Afghan officials in institutions and elsewhere so that they can shoulder more of the load themselves. I think that is possible. I supported that policy. And when that date approaches, I'll provide my best professional military advice on it to the president and to the NATO chain of command.
President Karzai recently came out, though, and he was referencing the talk about July next year, and he was saying that the ISAF strategy is wrong. What do you have to say to that?
Well, I think at times there's some misunderstanding about, again, what July 2011 represents. There has been a misinterpretation that this is when we race for the exits and find the light switch to turn them out before we leave the room, and that's not the case. So clearly it's incumbent on us to continue to explain what July 2011 really is, and the fact that, again, the pace of what will happen is very much based on conditions, which seems eminently sensible and logical to me, and also that sending a message of urgency is, something I think is helpful as well. There is also discussion about the need to do more about the sanctuaries in Pakistan, and I think that's an understandable topic to be raised, and it is one that obviously those at Central Command and beyond, and in my position as well, have had plenty of conversations about and will continue to have plenty of conversations about, not just with our Afghan partners, but with our regional partners as well.
Everyone knows that you're concerned about civilian casualties. You've issued strong guidance to try and minimize civilian casualties, but still incidents are occurring. What more can be done exactly?
Well, we have to continue to reinforce, and to every additional contingent that comes in has to be almost re-indoctrinated, if you will, in what it is that we are trying to do and how we are taking steps to keep civilian casualties at an absolute minimum, because we have reduced these very substantially. Even the United Nations just noted that even at a period where we have greatly expanded our forces, as I mentioned, increased by some 80-some-odd thousand, those civilian casualties attributed to our operations have been reduced by some 30%. That is quite an accomplishment. But clearly, there still are civilian casualties. Inevitably, tragically, there will be civilian casualties in the course of military operations. Our job is to drive them down to an absolute minimum, while still also, of course, ensuring that as we protect the civilians, we also protect our own force. And that's a very important balance that we must achieve. But if we incur civilian casualties in the course of a tactical victory, in quotes, that often ends up being a strategic setback. Our forces understand that. We have implemented instructions. I revised the tactical directive, tweaked that a bit, issued the counterinsurgency guidance that you have seen, all of which emphasizes, again, ensuring that we are protecting the population and not inflicting casualties on it. Now, tragically, the Taliban has done the opposite. Despite their pronouncements about protecting the population, as you know, the casualties attributed to the Taliban has gone up very significantly as measured by the United Nations.
But still, I mean, these incidents are occurring, and it seems to be that we're losing some of the public support here. There have been quite a few protests in the streets recently in certain areas. What would you say to the Afghan public? Why should they continue to support ISAF's presence here in Afghanistan?
Well, first of all, I think those have been pretty isolated incidents, and sometimes those have been more about local political power brokers trying to push something or other through or something like that. It is not uncommon to see some of these hijacked, if you will, for various purposes. And again, that's, you know, welcome to our world, welcome to the world of counterinsurgency operations. But I think the Afghan people, by any polls that we have seen, recognize the benefits to their country of having the coalition here, of having the international community striving to help continue the improvements that have been made in this country. I mean, by any measure, if you look at the number of, you know, thousands of additional miles of road, the additional health clinics, schools, cell phones, you name it, whatever it may be, sheer economic growth, since the Taliban, it has been very dramatic. And they recognize it. They don't want to turn the clock back several centuries to the kinds of practices that the Taliban inflicted on them when they closed girls. They see it now. I mean, the Taliban recently stoned a couple to death and then in another case flogged a pregnant woman before assassinating her. So I don't think they want to return to that. Except in those cases, to be fair, where the governance that has been provided for the people has been predatory in nature rather than service-oriented in nature. And in those cases, again, it reminds you of the importance of good governance that achieves legitimacy in the eyes of the people.
Now, the operations in Marja and Kandahar have dominated the news this year. You've already spoken about Marja, but in Kandahar, it seems things have really stalled there. What exactly is going on there?
Well, the Kandahar operation, the deliberate piece of that really has actually just begun. And the first manifestation of that has been the clearance of Argandab district, the bulk of which has been complete, but certainly, again, the enemy fighting back there. But, again, that is a step forward. There has been some additional activity in and around Kandahar City, the establishment of checkpoints around the city, a recent operation in the Malajat district of Kandahar City itself. There is the establishment of a battlefield surveillance brigade around the Weishaman border crossing to try to interdict more of what comes in from the sanctuary south of the border. And then over time, there clearly will be other operations, and those are planned, but we're not going to announce them in advance.
There seems to be a lot of activity down there at the moment of taking out key Taliban leaders. That seems to be the majority of the work that's going on that I read about, if I go by sort of press releases, etc., from what's happening in Kandahar. Is that right?
Well, that has been an important feature of what we call the shaping operations. As you begin to approach the conduct of clearing, holding, and building operations, you conduct shaping operations. And those are intended to give you better understanding of the nature of the insurgent network, to take down some of those leaders and members, certainly, to interdict the improvised explosive device efforts and those kinds of things. And that has been quite significant in the Kandahar area, but it's also been significant throughout the country. We've more than tripled the operational tempo of our special operations forces that conduct the kinds of precise targeted operations every 24-hour period.
How long is this fight going to take, and have you got enough time to achieve what you'd like here?
Well, no one in a position like this puts a date on this, and I certainly would not hazard that. What we do openly acknowledge is that this is going to take a sustained, substantial commitment. We've seen, again, that just in the last 18 months, we've finally gotten the inputs right. We're really now getting on with this. I think, in a sense, for the first time in a resourced, sufficiently resourced manner. Over time, clearly, the character of our involvement will evolve and be reduced in the military sense, even as we may stay engaged in other areas. And that's how we would want to take this forward.
Where are we heading with this mission, and what signs will show if you or ISAF have succeeded?
Well, I think we have seen that in some areas, again, as I mentioned earlier, that the additional security in a place like Nawa or Nadi Ali or Lashkargah districts of Helmand province are indicators of that. Certainly, Marja, early initial progress, but hard fought still, and the enemy still fighting to take it back, and that will take more effort. If you look again at Kabul City itself, as I mentioned, 1/6 of the population and a pretty secure city. I mean, this is not Baghdad. This is the second month I've been in command here. The second month I was in command in Iraq, there were 3 car bombs every day on average in Baghdad and dozens of attacks. I mean, you felt as if you were in a boxing ring with your hands up like this, literally. It was horrific, a terrible level of violence and civilian casualties and coalition and Iraqi casualties. And so, again, this is the strategically important oil spot. The enemy knows that. The enemy, there are threat streams out there, and we've interdicted a number of those in the course of recent months.
I just want to jump back to talking a bit more about your sort of current assessment of the fight that is going on now against the Taliban. Are you seeing much weakness in them? You know, signs of reintegration, etc. Long-term, do you think that the mission here will be able to break them down and that we will be able to leave the country in the hands of the Afghans and leave?
Well, there have been incidents of reintegration. In fact, just a couple more the other day. And the reintegration joint order was literally just published yesterday, officially. So these are actually somewhat premature. That is a hopeful development. Clearly, we must build on that with our Afghan partners. It will be Afghan-led. And you've got to convince the $10 a day Taliban, the rank and file, that it's time indeed to come in from the cold to be part of the new Afghanistan instead of an obstacle to the new Afghanistan. But this is a very comprehensive effort. So it takes targeted operations, again, against the leaders. It takes conventional clear, hold, and build operations of coalition and Afghan forces together. The new Afghan local police initiative, just beginning to get off the ground, will provide a very important augmentation and thickening to the effects of our forces by helping local communities that want to defend themselves against the Taliban to do that, but within a structured chain of command that comes out from the Ministry of Interior. There has to be politics. There will be opportunities for reconciliation with senior leaders, and those should be taken if indeed they meet the red lines that President Karzai has described. There has to be progress in governance so that the people do see the government, the governance that they have in their local areas, as legitimate and worthy of their support, being inclusive and transparent and obviously rejecting corruption and so forth. There's got to be intelligence fusion. There has to be improvement in the correction services, detainee operations, and so forth, so that there's rehabilitation. You separate the hardcore from the rank and file so that they can be rehabilitated back into society. And obviously, basic services have to be addressed, because it's in those areas that you might find individuals. It's because of that, because of inadequate basic services, inadequate opportunities, inadequate education, and so on, that people might be given to extremist leanings in the first place. There are some challenges outside Afghanistan, needless to say, that President Karzai has highlighted rightly. And there's going to have to be work with neighboring countries in that regard, and then in other ways perhaps as well. And then we have to communicate all of this. This is, again, an information campaign as well as it is everything else. So it takes that kind of comprehensive approach. That's what can achieve progress. It's the only sensible approach, I think, to achieving our overall objectives of a country that doesn't have extremist safe havens that could result in more 9/11 attacks or more subway attacks or airport attacks or what have you. And that is, again, the approach, I think, that is appropriate. It's in very much in accordance with the NATO comprehensive approach as described by the North Atlantic Council.
And it's well within our reach, do you think, if all these elements come into play? Because I think there's still a public perception that it's just not doable.
Well, I think we have to show the public clearly that progress can be achieved and can be built on, and then that over time that our very important objectives here can be accomplished.
But people are getting weary, though. Support is waning, you know, in NATO countries with troops on the ground. I've embedded with troops that have questioned what this is all about. I mean, what would be your message to them? Why should they get up tomorrow and go out on patrol again?
Well, because the mission is hugely important to our countries. That's why we are here. It's important to remember that. I understand those frustrations. I think, with respect, I've been deployed about as much as any person in this country since 2001, having been in Bosnia for a year, then 4 years in Iraq, many 300 days out of 365 on the road at CENTCOM, and then here. So I certainly, in my family and other families, we all, again, you know, that frustration has a face on it. The casualties have faces on them as well. There's nothing easy about this. And again, it is very, very understandable that there would be impatience and a desire to see progress right now. But the nature of these endeavors is such that that progress is slow, it's hard fought. And as I mentioned earlier, the fact is that we are just now, for the first time, getting the inputs right. I mean, arguably, we had a very short war up front. We had a number of years of an under-resourced campaign. And again, I think at the time, people would not have seen it that way. It's understandable. But as you look back now, you now realize how the Taliban was able to come back and reestablish itself. We've worked hard over the last 18 months to rectify that. And now what we need to do is achieve progress and show the world that this can indeed be accomplished.
You've got a very tough, difficult job. What motivates you on a daily basis?
Well, what motivates me are the young men and women out there in various coalition uniforms and Afghan uniforms, and then Afghan citizens who all have pulled together to try to achieve something for this country that is of enormous importance, not just to those who live here and those in the region, but again, to those back home as well.